From Interfaith Alliance, this is State of Belief Radio. I'm your host, Reverend Welton Gaddy, broadcasting this week from Monroe, Louisiana.
Charleston has become the first West Virginia city to ban so-called conversion therapy for LGBTQ children and teens.
No one should be in the business of trying to shame or humiliate these kids simply for being gay.
Well, a lot of unconscionable regulation making has been taking place at the state and local level. That's also where positive change has been taking place as well. This week, the West Virginia capital city of Charleston passed an ordinance banning discredited ex-gay pseudotherapy for minors. We'll hear from Fairness West Virginia Executive Director Andrew Schneider.
The vaccines change your DNA.
Vaccines cause infertility.
Microchips are being implanted with the vaccine.
As the next wave of the corona crisis sweeps over our nation, disproportionately impacting vaccine-refusing parts of the population, experts are speaking out on both the treatment and the denialism. Dr. Christopher Beam has been working at the intersection of science and skepticism for decades, and we'll get his perspective on this week's State of Belief Radio.
House Democratic leaders failed to round up enough votes on Friday to pass legislation extending the federal ban on evictions just 2 days before it is set to expire, ultimately adjourning the chamber for a long summer recess with no path forward on the issue.
In an age of partisan gridlock and largely manufactured widespread public distrust of our government leaders, it's more important than ever to cut through the noise and rancor to focus on what's important and possible. Interfaith Alliance Director of Policy and Advocacy, Catherine Joseph, has that job, and she does it very well. We'll get an update on the issues and initiatives the Alliance is making its priority as it works to defend true religious freedom for all.
I'm Ray Kirstein, reporting from the intersection of religion, government, and the World Wide Web. Religion News Service reports that Facebook has now deployed a Pray With Me feature for groups. It offers users a way to ask for prayer for or about anything from a job interview to a serious illness to presumably a ballgame. The responses include an I Prayed button. I suppose it's only a matter of time before we all get the option to post a thoughts and prayers response to the broad range of bad news, suffering, and scandal that social media continues to thrive on. Recalling that it was the Washington State Catholic Conference in 1983 that declared, quote, prejudice against homosexuals is a greater infringement of the norm of Christian morality than is homosexual activity, end quote, New Ways Ministry has published a statement online headlined, A Home for All, a Catholic Call for LGBTQ Non-Discrimination, which bears the signatures of a large and growing number of prominent Catholic clergy, theologians, and leaders. And new research from the Springtide Institute reports that while younger Americans are the most likely to identify as religiously unaffiliated, that doesn't mean they're turning away from spirituality. Quite the contrary. Curating their belief systems like so many social media feeds, more than half of these children of the internet age, 13 to 25, say they engage in tarot card or fortune telling, some of them daily. Others follow horoscopes religiously, use crystals, and explore other aspects of ancient spirituality and magic, all while sharing beliefs and experiences with each other on TikTok and other trendy online platforms of the 21st century.
Our program airs every weekend on radio stations nationwide and is available as a podcast and iTunes and other leading podcast platforms. I urge you to subscribe to it today. State of Belief Radio is made possible in great part by the generous support of our listeners. If you've made a donation this week, please let me say thanks to you. If you haven't pitched in yet, information on how you can help keep this show on the air is available at stateofbelief.com. That's stateofbelief.com. And now, to our first guest. The state capital of Charleston is a metropolis with a proud history and a diverse population, and its council took an important step toward protecting its young people this past week. With details, I'm delighted to be joined by Andrew Schneider, Executive Director of Fairness West Virginia. Andrew, welcome to State of Belief Radio.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
In a nutshell, what was the breakthrough ordinance you all are celebrating the passage of this week?
It's an ordinance that bans the dangerous and discredited practice of conversion therapy. This is the so-called therapy that claims to be able to change one's sexual orientation or gender identity. And all the major medical associations, both nationally and in West Virginia, have come out in opposition to it because it really can threaten these young people's lives. It leads to suicide. It leads to certainly to depression. And it doesn't work. It doesn't help. It only harms. And so Charleston City Council members and the mayor came out strongly in opposition to this practice by banning it in Charleston city limits.
The unconscionable quackery of conversion therapy continues to scar lives and families across the nation and actually across the world. At the same time, there's a lot of lawmakers to be distracted by these days. How was Fairness West Virginia able to hold their attention on this important piece of legislation?
Well, we've been working on this legislation for years. We've brought it before the state legislature every year since 2015. And even though that is probably our most popular bipartisan bill of all the bills that we have introduced, the leadership of the legislature, of both the Senate and the House, have refused to allow it to come up for a vote, even though we would have the votes to pass it statewide if they were allowed to be voted on. Mm. So because of our frustration over these past 6 years of not being able to ban this horrible practice and abusive practice statewide, we've now turned to the municipalities, just as we've done on the Fairness Act, our other legislation that bans discrimination in employment, housing, and public spaces. And we've had some success. You know, we've a lot of success with the local fairness laws municipally. We've gotten 15 municipalities to adopt these bans on discrimination that we call the local fairness laws. So we thought that the same strategy might prove successful for our ban on conversion therapy. And certainly with Charleston, it was. And we hope that now that Charleston has set the example, that we can now get other communities to take up this legislation and do the same right and just thing by banning it in their communities as well.
Well, I'd love to hear about the partnerships, the cooperation, including faith communities.
Oh, the faith community has been great. We have been working with faith communities for many years now, realizing that West Virginia is a very religious state, a very devout state, mm-hmm. takes religion very seriously. And at the same time, the attacks off against us, against LGBTQ people, often come from a religious source. But we know that those attacks only represent a small minority of faith people of faith, that the vast majority of faith people and leaders of faith actually support non-discrimination based on the Golden Rule. I mean, it's that universal religious principle that you find in almost every major religion. Do unto others as you would want them to do unto you. And that is essentially the mission of our organization. That is the mission of Fairness. We are about the Golden Rule. We just simply want to be treated the way others would like to be treated. Hmm. And that is probably as succinctly as I can describe what Fairness does.
There is so much weaponized rhetoric flying around that is tragically all too often successful in delegitimizing or diluting LGBTQI plus lives and issues in the public square. How were you able to avoid that happening in Charleston?
Well, we employ the same same technique and strategies as we have as long as I've been here, which is simply treat people with respect, even if they disrespect you. I never engage in personal attacks because as a result of that, the leaders respect me as an individual. Then I operate in a civil space and I treat people with civility. And I encounter many, many people who attack me, for who I am and who I love. And I don't let that get under my skin. It's tough. I mean, it took me many years to come to this point where I've developed a thick skin, but I never respond in kind to those kinds of attacks. I simply respond with the facts and with the emotions of wanting to be treated fairly. That's basically as simple as I can put it. And as a result of that, I think, council members and other elected officials have been able to support us and not run into the problems where it becomes a food fight and, gets ugly and their support, wavers as a result of that.
Sure.
So we've been, we certainly faced that, the attacks during this conversion therapy vote, and some of them were pretty ugly and nasty. And we just responded with how harmful this is to our kids and that we have to protect our kids. And ultimately that is what won the vote and won the day.
Hmm. Do you expect court challenges to this ordinance as we've seen the political religious right launch against other common sense human rights protections in the past?
There could always be court fights. That is always a possibility. But I was involved in the drafting of this ordinance, and we made sure that it was airtight. I don't know if you know this about me, but I have a background as having served as director of two ACLU state offices. I ran the ACLU in West Virginia, and I ran the ACLU in Connecticut. And so I'm very sensitive and careful about making sure that any of these bills and legislation do not infringe on constitutional rights. In fact, that they would only advance protections and not take away any. So we made sure that this particular bill and now law does not run afoul of the First Amendment, does not run afoul of freedom of religion or freedom of speech. And I feel completely confident that this will stand up in court.
Hmm. Are you worried that the state legislature might do something to undo the progress that you've made on protecting Charleston's youth from the torture of ex-gay treatments?
We never take anything for granted. My first legislative session with Fairness as their director and chief lobbyist was a fight against a bill in the state legislature to ban or prohibit local municipalities from adopting these non-discrimination laws, these local fairness laws. And we generated thousands of emails and phone calls to legislators to the point where the Republicans who are in charge of our legislature and have been so since I've been here came up to me and said, we've told our leadership that we cannot support this legislation, that we do not want this bill to come up for a vote because it's just too controversial. And that was a result of all of the backlash that we were able to generate from simply getting the word out that this legislation was threatening local control and local autonomy and local authorities. We called it the Abolishing Local Liberty Law, in fact, because that's, as you pointed out, was something that particularly the Republicans had been known for to oppose, that they believe in local control, particularly when they're fighting against the federal government. Mm-hmm. So we pointed out that contradiction, and we ultimately won that vote. Those types of bills have come up every year since, but since we defeated that in the legislature when it was about to come up for vote with the House of Delegates, and that was probably one of the most staunchly anti-LGBTQ legislatures that I've ever worked worked with, and the fact that we defeated it then I think bodes well for the future. But I also would point out that our legislature has become increasingly conservative and in opposition to LGBTQ people, most recently after the last election. And so I do feel like this is a bill that might come up next year and that we're probably going to have to fight it again. And we will.
Public awareness of how harmful this practice is continues to grow, most recently thanks to the Netflix documentary Pray Away. What would you say to other communities like yours that are looking for ways to leverage this awareness and enact legal protections from ex-gay abuse? Is there a network of experienced leaders like yourself, resource of best practices or other kinds of strength in numbers support available?
Well, I think this is why these laws are so important, because they not only ban this horrible and abusive practice among licensed therapists, but even those that these laws can't get at legally, like faith leaders. You know, this practice is probably predominantly practiced by faith leaders, you know, that minority I was talking about earlier, right, that is anti-gay. This law will help to educate, or these laws will help to educate, most importantly, parents, to know that this is a dangerous and harmful practice to their kid, to subject their kids to. And then every time we go through this battle, there's an enormous amount of debate that surrounds it before the body of government votes on this particular legislation. And that body of debate helps to educate the public. It helps to identify this practice as something that is, first of all, pseudoscientific, and secondly, and more importantly, is dangerous to their children's health and welfare.
Yeah.
And so that's why these laws serve a twofold purpose. One, to actually ban and punish the practice among licensed therapists, but also to educate the public as a whole and protect our kids.
What else is Fairness West Virginia working on, and how can our listeners engage with and support the work you're doing?
Well, I would love to direct your listeners to our website. It's Fairness WV, FairnessWV.org. Go to our website, sign up as a volunteer, sign up as a supporter, learn more about what we're doing. We're always working on several non-discrimination battles at a time. We could definitely use your support. And this is a fight worth fighting for here in West Virginia, because it's a great state here. People are super friendly, and we want to make this place even better, even friendlier, even more inclusive.
Andrew Snyder is executive director of Fairness West Virginia, which led the campaign for passage this week of an ordinance in the state capital of Charleston banning the perpetration of ex-gay abuse on young people there. Andrew, it was a pleasant surprise to discover there's at least one State of Belief listeners on your team there. I'm always amazed at the reach of this program and proud of it. Keep up the great work, and thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you, and thank you for inviting me onto your program. I very much appreciate it.
We're just getting started with this week's show. Up next, I'll talk with Christopher Beam about his recent article, Why Refusing the COVID-19 Vaccine Isn't Just Immoral, It's Un-American. And later, Interfaith Alliance Director of Policy and Advocacy, Katie Joseph. You're listening to State of Belief Radio, brought to you by Interfaith Alliance. I'm Welton Gaddy. The more every public issue seems to get hijacked by partisanship, and the more fossilized partisan divides seem to become, the more critical important it becomes to find ways to engage across that divide, especially when the issue is one that affects all of us, as is the case with the far from over COVID-19 pandemic. As some communities in this country yet again face life-threatening shortages of medical care resources, the Religion News Service headline caught my eye. Why refusing the COVID-19 vaccine isn't just immoral, it's un-American. The writer states from the outset that he has a long history of convening scientists and skeptics, and that was more than enough reason to invite Dr. Christopher Beam to be with us today. Christopher, welcome to State of Belief Radio.
Thank you very much. My pleasure to be here, and please call me Chris.
Okay, Chris, I'll do that. You write that this conflict of individual right versus the collective good is nothing new in democracy. So let's start with the conference that you mentioned organizing decades ago and how that informs your take on the current conflict.
Well, that's a good question. I mean, it happened, you know, in the 90s, and It was my job to organize these conferences at an operating center, and what struck me was that everything this woman was saying was absolutely true, right? She was saying that she was arguing against any kind of vaccine mandates, and she said that you as in the government, as in, you know, the medical science community, is demanding that I put this vaccine in my child, a live biological agent, and you are offering me no guarantee that that vaccine is going to not end up causing this kind of serious medical reaction. And the fact is that over the course of the long course of this MMR vaccine, some children have died. Some children have died of either anaphylactic shock or what have you. It is an incredibly small number, literally in the 0.000 number, but it does happen. And so it occurred to me right when I was listening to this that her argument speaks to the inadequacy of sustaining a society on self-interested, rationality alone. Mm-hmm. It's not to say that that there isn't an argument there. It's not to say that there isn't a legitimate assessment of risk within the terms of self-interest. But it is to argue that in any society, and especially in a democracy, that kind of analysis is not sufficient. Hmm. We have to also ask, what are the consequences of my decisions on other people and on the society at large?
Chris, I'm curious, are you hearing the same arguments today that you heard back then? And how do you try to counter those arguments?
You know, it's really interesting you should say that. You know, I've gotten a lot of response to this. I mean, I don't go looking for fights, but I always say what I think. And this one caused a lot of reaction. And that's fine. I mean, I understand that. But I am struck by how many people who are responding to me are arguing within the context, continue to argue within the context of this self-interested risk assessment. So what they'll say is, no, you don't know what you're talking about with respect to how many people have died or how many people have, you know, been harmed by the vaccine, or, you know, I have enough antibodies because I've had it all already, right? So it's all these empirical claims about their assessment of their own risk. But I don't see, it's hard to say none, but I cannot off the top of my head think of one response that said that has addressed the issue of this concern for other people. You know, I'm not a scientist, right? I've done my best to say things that, you know, are true and which are supported by scientific evidence. But my argument is ethical. It's about what do we need to sustain a democratic society? And I think the frame of this COVID argument about COVID speaks to a broader ethical question, you know, namely, how much do we need to be concerned about other people in this democracy? And are we meeting that level right now? And I would argue that the answer to that second question is no.
If we go deeper in the nation's history, what fundamental values of interdependence inform the way you think we are obligated to look at this issue?
Well, that's a good question. I actually just finished a book called Democratic Virtues, and so I've been thinking a lot about this. But the reason I quoted Madison is because it's in the book, and I had spent a lot of time thinking about him specifically. Precisely because Madison is the one who accepts the reality of human beings, right? He was a student of Witherspoon at Princeton, and Witherspoon was a Calvinist preacher.
Right.
And there's this, you know, fundamental notion within Calvinism that we are both, you know, slaves to sin and made in the image of God. And unless you can frame your politics in a way that acknowledges both of those realities and not just one, you're in for trouble. And so that's what Madison did, right? He acknowledged that we're not angels. We're going to operate in terms of our own self-interest. But he also said that we human beings are not merely selfish, and democracy demands that we not be merely selfish. And if we are, I mean, selfish, self-interested, I know selfish is a little bit more pejorative way to say it. Just say self-interested. If that's all we are, it's going to be hard to sustain a democracy. Mm-hmm. And let me just say one more thing. I went through, I did, you know, Google searches on virtue and just about every founder I could think of. And there are 20 founders who say precisely the same thing. That, you know, whether they understand virtue to be religion or natural law or moral sense or however they understand it, they argue that these institutions we're setting up are not enough, mm-hmm. that self-interest is not enough, we have to, in order to make a democracy work, we have to have some sense of integrity, honesty, accountability, and also some concern for others.
Please talk about how our democracy itself offers a rational way to address a conflict of interest that on the surface seems impossible to resolve.
Yeah, it is a very difficult issue, right? People are dug in and they have attached their identity to one side or the other. And that makes democracy very difficult. But what I would argue is that that is the only game in town in terms of democracy. Mm-hmm. Take any issue that's been on the public's plate for the last 20 years, abortion, gun control, climate change. You can say exactly the same thing about those issues, that people are dug in and that they have attached their position to their own sense of who they are. And they think it's incredibly important. And when somebody takes a contrary point of view, it's impossible for us not to take that argument as a kind of personal assault. Welcome to democracy. Mm. We have to come up with ways to accept that that's going to happen, to assume that it's going to happen, and yet figure out ways to approach argument and approach procedure whereby we can live together without killing each other. And so, you know what? That's the only game in town. Mm. Because really, if we're not going to do that, then we are left with either tyranny or civil war. And you see that in our own history, and you see that throughout the world. So if you want to be able to, if you think democracy is a good thing, or even less, if you think tyranny and civil war are bad things, then you need to accept that people are going to disagree and you have to live with them anyway.
So we're at the most toxic part of the situation facing us. The language and imagery of patriotism has been hijacked by the likes of the January 6th terrorists at the U.S. Capitol building, as well as by anti-science agitators. With this level of manipulation in evidence, is it actually even possible to disentangle the issue itself from the political weaponization thereof?
Well, it may very well not be, right? It may just be that we are in a condition where for the foreseeable future, it's not possible for an argument to emerge from the tribal reality in which we find ourselves now, right? I mean, you could, it seems to me like the question about public health and vaccination should be able to rise above partisanship. The fact that it isn't speaks to just how bad things are right now. And, you know, it's entirely possible that it's going to take a while to get out of that. But it's incumbent upon us to try. Those of us who are Democrats, small d, it's incumbent upon us to try. I don't know that there's any real alternative. And I guess that's kind of what I was trying to do. Mm-hmm. The other thing that I was trying to do is to argue that, along with patriotism, you know, the idea of the true Americans is a concept that's been captured by this, the folks who were involved in the January 6th uprising and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And I wanted to argue that, I'm not letting you have that ground without pushing back, right? I mean, I want to argue that accepting the rightful moral demands of others is something that is incumbent upon me as a Democrat. And if I'm not doing that, then I do think that is fair to claim or fair to call un-American.
we seem to be living in a National Enquirer version of America. And so the most outlandish conspiracy theory seems to gain traction more easily than the most thoroughly documented fact. So where do we go from here?
I think, you know, I'm not pushing my book. It won't be out for a long time. But the impetus for the book was that people kept asking me, what can I do? Right. And the book is kind of an effort to answer that question. You know, none of us are responsible for the media climate or the climate on Capitol Hill or, you know, what the incentive structure is for politicians. But we can be responsible for our own behavior. And if we conduct ourselves with as much honesty, humility, consistency, self-criticism, openness to the possibility that we could be wrong, and engaging arguments fairly, that's what we can do. Mm-hmm. And that's what we should be doing. Knowing that all of us are going to, you know, fail at this from time to time, mm-hmm. knowing that our biases are so powerful that we don't even know often when they're operative. Mm-hmm. Knowing all that, it's still incumbent upon us to set these kind of standards for our own behavior.
Chris, are you hopeful that this current crisis will somehow get resolved in the long run with our pluralistic democracy intact, or are there fundamental changes that we now see need to take place?
Well, I mean, for my money, it's a lot like climate change, right? Mm. I mean, the last report is absolutely dire, right? I mean, it is as much a crisis, a global crisis, as we've seen, you know, I don't know how far you'd have mm-hmm. to go back to say that, right? Mm-hmm. Maybe beyond human history. Mm-hmm. But it's entirely possible, I guess, that our efforts will fail. But that doesn't in any way legitimate a kind of quietism. Whatever, eat, drink, and be merry because tomorrow we die. Yeah. I mean, there's nothing legitimate about that. There's nothing moral about that. And so I would just say the same thing about our democracy. Yeah, it's really bad. And I don't know anybody anywhere in American politics who doesn't agree that it's really bad. But none of that gives us the right to throw up our hands and to say, well, you know, we had a good run, didn't we? 250 years, whatever, you know, and now we're going to go back. You know, I mean, I just don't think that is a responsible moral thing to do. Mm-hmm. Doesn't mean that it's going to work. It may not. You know, I mean, John Adams said that there isn't a democracy yet that hasn't committed suicide. And it may just be that we're going to prove him right once again. But that doesn't mean that, you know, we can just quit. I guess that's what I would say.
Dr. Christopher Beam is managing director of the McCourtney Institute for Democracy at Penn State College of the Liberal Arts. His books include The Necessity of Politics and Democratic Humility, Reinhold Niebuhr's Neuroscience and America's Political Crisis. Chris, it's so helpful to get a more big picture take on this current logjam. Thank you for taking the time to be with us on State of Belief today, and make a promise to us that when that book is published, you'll get in touch with us and tell us so we can get you on again.
I'd be happy to do that. I really enjoyed the conversation, Malcolm. Thanks very much.
I can remember how little news used to be made on Capitol Hill during the dog days of summer. But that was back when lawmaking was more public service and less blood sport. Now, every moment of inattention can have grave and long-lasting consequences. That's why Interfaith Alliance is as busy as at any other time of the year, and why I'm happy to welcome Alliance Director of Policy and Advocacy, Katie Joseph, back to State of Belief Radio. Katie, thanks for being with us again.
Thanks for having me.
Before they fled for vacation, lawmakers in Washington did manage to pass a couple of bills that made headlines. Which among those bills involve issues that are priorities for Interfaith Alliance?
So we've seen a lot of movement on Capitol Hill in the last few weeks. And in some ways, it feels a little bit strange to say that, because that has not been the case in recent months. But the two major packages that have taken up most of Congress's time have been, first and foremost, the infrastructure package, including some comprehensive and at times tense conversations about what infrastructure means across the country. And the second of which is the bipartisan push around the budget reconciliation bill. So first and foremost, within the infrastructure package, this is really focusing on the physical supports that make our country move forward. We're talking about bridges. We're talking about roads. We are talking about investments in a green economy by making sure that there are more electric cars available to limit our carbon footprint. But as we're thinking about that for Interfaith Alliance, we are always watching out for questions around the separation of religion and government, and around equity in how taxpayer dollars are being spent. Many of these programs, say around making sure that our buildings are using more green energy, they're set up as grant programs. So these are taxpayer dollars that are available to institutions to apply for. And anytime there's a grant program administered by the government, whether it's a federal, state, or local program, there are requirements for applicants to meet. So within this infrastructure bill, there are grants available to improve, for instance, high-speed internet access. But there's been some attention paid to requirements that recipients of those grants agree to participate in non-discrimination requirements. So that means, as they're administering taxpayer funds, that they're not discriminating against folks based on race, sexual orientation, gender identity, religious affiliation, and other protected characteristics. And frankly, this makes sense. We don't want taxpayer dollars being used to then turn around and discriminate against taxpayers. Yeah. But there's a small number of religiously affiliated groups that have lifted up what has become something of a common trope, and saying that if we're not allowed to discriminate, say, based on sexual orientation or gender identity, then that is somehow a violation of our religious freedom. And that's simply not what religious freedom means. But at Interfaith Alliance, we are staying vigilant and making sure that this manipulation of freedom of belief is not infused into these taxpayer-funded programs.
Are there achievements for the Alliance and its partners from the past few months that you'd like to highlight and celebrate?
So I'm going to give you a really nerdy answer to that question.
Okay.
And that's around budget reconciliation. Not particularly thrilling words to most people. But this is the first time in Congress we are seeing a sustained conversation about what infrastructure means, thinking beyond the physical supports, to think about human infrastructure, the care economy, education, childcare. And these are things that are essential in our communities. They're essential for ensuring that all people have the opportunity to thrive, that our kids are taken care of, that those who want to work are able to do so safely, that have not received attention in a meaningful way for the critical aspects of our success that they are. And so I see that as a huge accomplishment, that we are putting value in care work specifically that by and large has been done largely by women, often by women of color, that is not recognized for the incredible value it holds for our nation.
Katie, what's the work that advocacy groups like Interfaith Alliance can do during these next weeks while Congress is away? Because I know the city isn't shutting down the way it used to during these hot, humid days of August.
Hot and humid is right. So for many of us, while Congress may be a little quieter, things are picking up in the states. Kids are going back to school. And we are seeing a number of governors and state legislators attempting to politicize the movement back to in-person learning in ways that actually will expose children, teachers, staff, and families to an unsafe health situation, simply to make a political point. And in some states, I'm spending a lot of time watching what's happening in Florida. We are even seeing Governor DeSantis there take this opportunity to push school vouchers, which he has been a champion of for a long time, that allow parents to take money away from public schools toward private, often religious education for their child under the guise of quote unquote COVID harassment in public schools. Mm-hmm. The notion that if you are uncomfortable with your child wearing a mask or remaining distant, that is sufficient justification to reallocate public money away from these public institutions mm-hmm. and into religious ones. In our book, this is a church state issue because this is public money that's being used for religious education. But I would also go so far as to say that it is an opportunistic response to the COVID crisis in a place like Florida, where there are urgent, urgent needs that are not being addressed by the state government.
Katie, I know an important part of your work is organizing members to action around the key issues they count on Alliance to lead on. You've mentioned some already. What are others of these actions that you are focusing on?
So this is a moment, as throughout the pandemic, but particularly in this new wave that we are facing, for faith communities to lead by example. For faith leaders, for lay community leaders, to live out their faith by caring for one another. And that can mean distance worship as needed. That can mean hosting a vaccination site. That can mean getting the information, the accurate, the scientific information about the life-saving potential of vaccines, to those who are still hesitant. This work happens often on a one-to-one basis through hard conversations about making that decision to protect oneself, your family, and the community. So each of us have the opportunity to continue that work now, even though it may seem fraught, it may even seem political. For me, getting vaccinated was a matter of faith. Caring for myself, caring for those who are more vulnerable than I am by doing everything I can to make sure that I look out for them and their needs in this pandemic. Hmm.
I want to, while I've got you, I want to look ahead a little bit as well. As you look ahead to the fall, what are you focusing on from the White House and from Congress?
Well, when we come back in the fall, we are going to have an opportunity in Congress to address many of the issues, the top legislative priorities that, while important, have not been front of mind as these conversations about infrastructure and budget reconciliation have been going on. So for us, we have done a tremendous amount of work and will continue to mobilize faith communities and secular partners around the Equality Act, which would strengthen existing civil rights laws and close the gaps within federal protections to ensure all of us receive equal treatment in public space and create a national standard of civil rights protections for LGBTQ folks.
Hmm. I also want to ask that same kind of question related to the courts, but I also know that we could spend the rest of the day talking about that. But tell me what's at the top of your list that we're going to be dealing with.
Well, there are two cases that we're paying very close attention to before the Supreme Court. And the parties to those cases are going through the process of filing their briefs now. So some of this will take a little while until we have more detailed information about what oral arguments might look like. But the first is a case out of Maine that involves this question of school vouchers, the use of public funds for private religious education. This will be the second time the Supreme Court is taking up a case on this particular question in the last few years. So not only is it getting a lot of attention in the states, but our highest court will also weigh in on this matter as well. And then the second case, of course, is around access to abortion. And that case, while at its heart, is not being contested around questions of religious freedom, we know that the ability to make personal health decisions consistent with our own beliefs and needs is very much informed for many of us by our faith convictions. And when one group or politician tries to advance a law or a policy that's rooted in their beliefs around questions of abortion, it prevents patients and even doctors from proceeding in a way that is consistent with their own beliefs. Mm. So this is going to be a really difficult and painful case for many of us, but we are grateful to be in strong company with many of our faith-based partners who are thinking through these questions and recognize the need to make space for all of us to be guided by our religious convictions in making these decisions.
So I'm going to hop back now and say we know that Congress is probably coming back a little bit earlier. What do you need to be ready for when Congress gets back in session? It requires vigilance and preparation for action. What are you getting ready for?
It's really easy in Washington to get bogged down by the politics and the scoring points on a day-to-day basis, who's leading the news cycle, who's subtweeting who. And in the work that Interfaith Alliance does, we are guided by our values. And all of the policy decisions that we make, the organizing work that we do, is guided by our mission. And so when we come back in the fall, we're prepared certainly for the standard amount of DC political drama. But remembering why we do this work and the communities that we're fighting for, to make sure that all of us have the freedom to believe as we choose without fear of discrimination or harm, drives us and helps us measure just how much good we're able to accomplish.
The easiest question that I'm going to ask you is right now, would you please remind our listeners how they can follow and support the work of Interfaith Alliance, if you would?
I would invite everyone to please visit our website, www.interfaithalliance.org, to see the issues that we're working on now, the news stories that are breaking that we are directly involved in responding to, and opportunities to take action to advance true religious freedom for all.
Catherine Joseph is Director of Policy and Advocacy at Interfaith Alliance, defending true religious freedom for all. Katie, it's always great to talk with you. I appreciate what you're doing, proud of the work that you're doing. You're always welcome on State of Belief Radio, and today is another one of those times.
Thank you so much, Walton.
Well, that's all the time we have for this week's show. Your donations help keep us on the air. Please consider making a tax-deductible gift as we celebrate 15 years of continuous broadcasting. Information on how to donate is available at stateofbelief.com. That's stateofbelief.com. Stay up to date by subscribing to the free weekly State of Belief podcast on iTunes or your favorite podcast platform, and take a moment to follow us on Facebook and Twitter. Be part of the conversation. Social media helps connect like-minded people in conversation and company. I'd ask you to share State of Belief with just one person. Do that this week. One person for whom you think this might be helpful. Our producer is Ray Kirstein. State of Belief Radio is a production of Interfaith Alliance. Become a member today at interfaithalliance.org. You know, I say those last words every week. They are not perfunctory words. You need to be a part of what's happening with Interfaith Alliance. Our nation needs Interfaith Alliance, and Interfaith Alliance needs you. And be sure to join us next week for more stories from the intersection of religion, government, and politics. Until then, you all take care of each other. I'm Welton Gaddy. That's State of Belief.
The only one who could ever reach me was the son of a preacher man. The only boy who could ever teach me was the son of a preacher man. See you.